Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. And welcome to summer. It's finally arrived up here in the Pacific Northwest. I think many of us were beginning to doubt if it was ever going to happen this year. But it has, and it's arrived just in time because there are some great books coming out this summer. And there's nothing nicer than sitting outdoors and losing yourself in a good story. Today we have a listener favorite joining us. She's a really popular listener favorite. She's joining us with her brand new release. It's called Sugar and Salt, and I'm talking about Susan Wiggs. Last time we talked with Susan was about the Lost and Found bookshop set in San Francisco. And this latest story, Sugar and Salt, returns to Perdita Street with some great new characters and some intrigue. Susan Wiggs is a number one New York Times bestselling author. She's written more than 50 novels, including the beloved Lakeshore Chronicles series and the instant New York Times bestseller Family Tree. Her award-winning books have been translated into 24 languages, and she lives up here in the Pacific Northwest in the Puget Sound region on an island with her husband and family. So here's my guest, Susan Wiggs, and her book, Sugar and Salt. Susan Wiggs, welcome back. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. What a pleasure to be back with you again.
Well, it's great, and I've lost count, and it doesn't even matter how many times we've talked before, but it's always good to have you on the show. And this time we're talking about your latest book, Sugar and Salt. It's just out. And, you know, we have listeners from around the world, just like you have readers around the world, but it's always great to have an author with local connections. And you've made the Pacific Northwest your home. Your family is here. You love it here. So tell us a little bit about why you love it here.
You know, when I was a teacher, I was working in Texas, and I always wanted to live in a place that was that had mountains and the ocean. And I pictured this sort of idyllic setting in my mind because I love the mountains. I love to ski in the winter, but I love being on the beach. And so I sort of dithered around, and this was even before the internet. And so I kind of tried to target that. And then as a self-employed person, I also thought, wouldn't it be nice to live in a state that doesn't assess an income tax? And so I was coldly practical, and then I was also very drawn to the beautiful scenery up here. And I'm not one who minds the dark winters and the wet because I have a very, very indoor job. And so I figured, well, you know, winter will be my time to sort of hole up and get my reading and my writing done. And, you know, when, in our brilliant Northwest summers, that's when I'll go out and play. And pretty much that's what I do.
Sounds like a great plan to me. And I, too, remember looking for similar things. I lived in San Diego where we have mountains and beach, slightly different mountains that we have here. But it's such a great combination. And then you've got the advantages up here of that winter where you can just hunker down and nest and get all the work done. So sounds ideal.
It does. It does. I feel very lucky to be here. But I should say that a writer who is passionate, and I know you have a lot of listeners who are aspiring or working writers as well, a writer can write anywhere. I've written in closets and on trains and, and ferry boats and waiting rooms, so in my car.
Yes.
But it is nice to have a very idyllic setting to sit and spin my tails.
That's right. Professional writer gets their butt in the chair. So we're talking about Sugar and Salt today, your new book. It takes place in a familiar environment, San Francisco, the place of the Lost and Found bookshop. Why did you choose to go back to that area for this? And I think this book, the bakery in here was actually in the Lost and Found bookshop, if I recall correctly.
Oh, you have eagle eyes, Vicky, because it was just a dropped-in reference. As I was picking my idealized, very idyllic bookshop, you know, and setting that up for the Lost and Found bookshop, I thought, well, surely they need a coffee bar. And if there's a coffee bar, then surely they need some pull-aparts and some danishes and scones and, you know, lovely things like that. And so I gave her, in that book, I gave her a lovely neighborhood bakery just across the street. And I named it Sugar because I was in a hurry and I couldn't think of anything else. And so I sort of spun that into a real place. And I did love Perdita Street in San Francisco. And I still get inquiries from readers saying, you know, where is this street? I want to go to it because I've made it look so lovely and inviting. And so, yes, I had the setting probably and the name of the bakery before I had anything else. And despite the cover art, my main character is not the baker. The baker is Mr. Sexy Jerome Sugar.
Right. Right. Very sexy Jerome Sugar. And so let's talk a little bit about the story synopsis.
Yeah, absolutely. My main character, Margot, she also goes by Margie in her younger days. Anyway, my main character is a woman who doesn't have a lot of resources, but she has one God-given talent, and that is she makes amazing, amazing barbecue sauce, and she is being mentored by a very celebrated pitmaster in Texas, in the Texas Hill Country, named Cubby Watson, and he's like renowned throughout the Hill Country for his barbecue, and she's learning from him. She's creating and canning her own jars of sauce, and he's helping her sell them, and things are looking a little better for this very disadvantaged young woman when a very awful, traumatic event occurs in her life and sort of spins her off in a totally unexpected direction, and that's sort of the impetus of the book.
Right. And being a barbecue master, when she comes to San Francisco, she's looking for somewhere to set up shop, per se, and that's how she runs into Jerome Sugar Barnes.
She does. I've learned a lot about how to set up a business, and it was very kind of sad and ironic that I was writing this, how to launch a restaurant and how to start your own business in the middle of the pandemic when the worst hit businesses in the world were the restaurants. And so, but it did turn out that a lot of restaurateurs and investors in restaurants had a lot of time to give me because they were, you know, they didn't have any business at least, you know, for months and months at the beginning of the pandemic. And so I had a lot of talks with them about what's involved. And of course, it's very glossed over in a novel because the novel is not about the nitty gritty of setting up a business. But I loved dealing with the challenges that a person faces when they are following this dream and the rewards that could come if you play your cards right. And so it was a real deep dive into what could actually happen. And then one of the things that I came across was that some restaurants, in fact, one just down the road from me, have a shared kitchen. They might share it with a catering company. They might share it with a deli or, you know, some other like-minded business. And so I thought, wow, what if Sugar and Salt, that's the name of our barbecue restaurant, what if they had to share a kitchen and had that sort of push-pull relationship that I love to read about in my books and other people's books?
Yeah. I have to say, you have this knack, and this is, as a writer, you should take this as the highest compliment, I think, but as a writer, you have the knack of just drawing the reader in such an easy way. I had time to read one, maybe two chapters, you know, at this particular, when I started the book. Coming towards the end of chapter three, I'm like, oh my God, I'm running late. So I had to put it down. What do you attribute that to? I mean, years of practice, I'm guessing, comes into play at some point.
Well, years of practice, but also years of being a reader from, you know, I don't even remember when I started being a reader. I was so little, but I always love a story that makes me forget myself and where I am and where I'm supposed to be and what I'm supposed to be doing. And so I always strive for that, and it doesn't necessarily happen in the first draft, but one of the ironic things about writing is if you write, if you do your job well enough, then your technique is not noticeable, but the reader just sort of falls into the story and goes along on the journey with you.
Yeah, perfect. I want to talk about Ida B. She is such a character, and there's a great line in there. I think it's towards the end of the book, and she says to Margot, "Oh, you're fine. The only way to be bad at dancing is to have a bad time doing it." And I felt that kind of summed her up really well. Talk to us a little bit about Ida B and how she fits into this.
Oh, I did a lot of research because Ida B was a young black girl in San Francisco who came of age in the late 60s and early 70s. And, you know, dad was a preacher and they were rather strict, her parents were, and she sort of falls in with the Berkeley, San Francisco protest crowd, you know, Stokely Carmichael and the Black Panthers and protests against the Vietnam War. And I didn't know that much about this era, and so it was really a pleasure to kind of get to know that era of history. I mean, it wasn't always pleasant, but she was a person who seemed, I think, sort of typical of her times, who sort of grew in wisdom from being, you know, really racially marginalized to being a business owner, and I think she gained a lot of wisdom along the way. And I think the older I get, the more I put like older women with wisdom in my books. Hired to be one, I think. And so she's very, you know, her voice is not necessarily my voice, but I loved adding her perspective to these much younger characters and her life experience. And she has a whole story of her own that occurred to me based on a little piece that I read about a town in northern British Columbia where a lot of draft dodgers from the U.S. Ended up settling down. And I don't know, it just I sort of put that together, and it turned into an interesting background for the story and some that made some real-world complications for Ida and for her son as well.
Yes, so tell us a little bit about Jerome and how you developed his character, because he's such a likable guy.
I don't know, like several hours of watching Bridgerton season one, maybe. you know, he's a guy, so he is not that complicated. You know, he's a great guy. He's quite idealized. Not only does he look like a, you know, Bridgerton character in the flesh, but he's also, you know, he's a single dad. He's very devoted to his two little boys, and he has inherited the business from his mom, and has done a really great job with it. But his first marriage didn't work out, and so he's really kind of flailing a bit from that. But he's an incredibly, you know, talented and understanding person, because, you know, due to the really, really harsh trauma that Margot suffers in the book, I wanted her main love interest and her partner to sort of be her soft place to fall. And so he's actually soft in the right places, soft heart. Hard in the right places too, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I want to share a quote from Booklist. They write about sugar and salt. Susan Wiggs writes with compassion and insight on some challenging topics, including abortion, racism, prison reform, and sexual assault. This is another winner. So these are all tough, real-life situations. You know, not just topics of the moment, but conversations that have been going on for many years and need resolution. And I know really your storyline is about how to find the strength to get through these times. But I'm wondering, as an author, how you get in the headset to write these scenes when you're having to deal with difficult topics.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think, Vicki, you think like a writer, because as you're writing, you're actually living it deeply in the book. And so the difficulties that she faces and the real trauma were pretty tough, and they were based on my readings and interviews of people in sexual assault and trauma research and who work in that field, and also in justice and prison reform and things like that. And so I really had to, this was really hard. I tried to make myself walk through this experience with this girl. I think she's 19 when it occurs, and depict it through her eyes, not through my eyes as somebody who's an older woman and a mom and a grandmother and, you know, with a very strong convictions about right and wrong. I had to sort of divorce myself from that and be that person. And so hopefully those scenes ring true. They are hard to read. And during the editing process, I actually did tone some things down based on feedback from not just my editor, but from her assistant. And so I definitely pay attention to that because I don't want readers to be traumatized, but I do want them to feel that the character is authentic and what happened to her is authentic.
Yes, and, you know, as I said, these are real life situations, and I'm sure many people can relate to them too. So was there a favorite scene for you when you were writing this?
Oh, a favorite scene. Yeah, you know, it's actually a very poignant scene, and spoiler alert a bit, she ends up, I don't even know if I want to spoil it. But
no, don't spoil it. That's okay. You can just...
Yeah. Well, it was her scene with the couple named Lindsay and, now I'm losing the partner's name. Anyway, this couple that ends up being very influential and helpful in her life, a scene when she departs from them. That one just really touched my heart, and it was very heart-touching to write.
Mm. So let's talk about some of the research. You've talked about some of the things that you looked at. What surprised you most when you were doing your research? Obviously, you were covering a lot of topics during that research, but was there something that really, like, stopped you in your tracks?
There was, and I remember I was researching small towns, small counties in Texas, and there's a I think it's an online-only newspaper called the Texas Tribune, and there was a piece in there about a woman named Thalita Hicks, and she wrote it. I think she's also now a very accomplished poet and writer in her own right, but it was an article about how she ended up being detained in the Hays County Jail for 45 days without being charged or anything, and she had been, I think, pulled over for a broken tail light and an expired registration or something like that. She's a woman of color in a very, you know, sketchy situation. And so, it was really remarkable because it kind of got me down a rabbit hole of the way that small county jail systems can be like these little individual fiefdoms where one person is in charge, and if he is... you know, problematic, that you have no recourse, especially if you have no resources, as my main character did. I was pretty surprised that in this, I guess I'm still too idealistic. I think, you know, justice, it's equal justice under the law. Well, I discovered, no, it's not. And so that's a topic that does, you know, I don't hit it really hard in the book, but it's something that surprised and dismayed me, but made for really, really good dramatic fiction. So I was kind of on the edge of my seat thinking, how is she going to get out of this situation? So.
Right. And it is shocking in the United States of America for that kind of thing to be happening. But we do hear about it every day, unfortunately.
We do.
I have to share, I love when I learn new words, and I learned a new word in your book. It's friable, and it means easily crumbled.
when you do a lot of fancy baking, you learn that.
Right, and you've got, you talk about food a lot through this book, because of course we've got the, you know, sugar bakery, and we've got the salt barbecue restaurant, and I'm telling you, my mouth kept watering all the time. I was like,
I'm happy to hear that. And I was so happy when I turned it in without with the descriptions, but without the recipes, and one of the first questions from my editor at William Morrow Books was, can we get some recipes, and what if we included some of them in the back of the book? And so I said, whoa, I've got recipes, because I do like to kind of live inside the book, as I've mentioned, and the pleasurable part of that was the baking and the barbecuing that I did.
Yes, I was thinking when I was reading this, Susan, please tell me you've tried every delicious pastry you write of and ate a whole bunch of Texas barbecue. And you do put some recipes at the back, from cocktails to red hot raging barbecue sauce and your mama's moist cornbread to, what was it, brisket Kaisers and Texas sheet cake. And I think it was the brisket Kaisers that where they put crisps or chips on a sandwich, right?
Oh my gosh, yes, that one is a non-negotiable ingredient. You've got to crush up the chips and sprinkle them on the top of the sandwich.
Well, I used to, that was my favorite sandwich as a kid, especially if it had cheese on it. I would love to get salt and vinegar crisps and just, I didn't crumble them, I layered them on there and then squished it all together.
Oh, I love the way you think, yes. So, yeah, I think that it just adds an extra little, I don't know, in Louisiana parlance, they call it a lagniappe, a little something extra to the back of the book. And so I was pleased to do that. And I absolutely did. I probably, for every recipe that made the cut, I probably tried five that didn't and, you know, probably have the hips to show the damage. So I'm thinking the next book I write needs to be about an athlete or somebody who, you know, doesn't sit around and cook all day.
Well, let's talk about timelines. You have a couple of timelines in the book, and there is definitely an art to writing multiple timelines, because if not done well, they can be very jarring to the storyline. They can totally interrupt the flow of the story, and then I kind of lose interest, but not so with your books. So when you're writing a story that has multiple timelines, how do you approach that?
I usually tell the story in the first draft chronologically. You know, this happened in 2007. That's, you know, in this particular book, that's when the backstory does. But I had two bits of really good advice from my literary agent long ago, and from my editor, and that was start the story at a very dynamic point. And then go back and retrieve the past, you know, as you tease the reader along, what, you know, why is she doing this? What is going on in her head? What is this secret thing that she's fleeing? And you raise questions in the reader. And so by the time they turn the page and we're back into the past, the reader's sort of hungry to fill in those blanks. And so usually it's not the first draft where I juggle the sequence of events, but it's definitely you know, part of the story. And there is a bit of a lengthy backstory, but I hope that the reader goes along with it, because it's really relevant to who this character turned out to be that we meet in the very beginning, when she's really trying to start her restaurant. And the other thing that about timelines is, my editor said, could we make everything happen before the pandemic started? Because like I mentioned, I was writing it during the pandemic, and she was concerned that if I had it happen in, you know, currently, we didn't know what was going to happen in summer of 2022, and we had to make this decision in 2020, and she said, let's not even have to go there, and we'll just say that it happened in 2017 or 2019, whenever we decided. And it just simplified things. It added more verisimilitude, than, you know, people won't suspend their disbelief if you have this vibrant, successful restaurant celebrating itself in the middle of a pandemic.
Well, yeah, it's a really good point. Very good point. So there are some great quotes in this book too. I liked this one from, I'm not going to read it all, it's quite long, but from Sam Sifton. He's the food editor at New York Times. I think he's a managing editor of Culture.
Read him every day, yeah.
Yeah. And I like this one where he says he's always nattering on about cooking brings to your life, what it brings to your life and to your mood, and that It's a force for tranquility in the face of the strange. You know, I know so many people who've been, you know, especially during the pandemic, and even now, they're saying their minds are so busy, their minds are so scattered, they can't focus, and forget meditation because, you know, I'm just going bzzz all over the place. But it's really about finding something that gets you so engrossed, you just totally switch off at some point, right?
It is, and I find as time goes on, I've written many, many books, but now that I'm, you know, I have a lot less, you know, I'm not raising family anymore. I'm actually raising my elderly mom, but that's a different story. But I end my day pretty predictably every day at the cocktail hour, and so there's something about switching gears. It's a different headspace to go and prepare cocktails and a meal than it is to write hours and hours of fiction. And so I always appreciate that. And so I loved the Sam Sifton quote that sort of he expressed it better than I ever could have. So I wanted to start it because I wanted Margie in the book, or Margot, to understand that she can heal herself if she follows her passion.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's true for all of us. And I harp on it about this all the time, but for me, in it's nature and getting out in nature. And no matter how crazy things are, if I'm out, you know, on the water or in the woods listening to the birds, you know, I can totally switch off there. What works for you apart from cocktail hour and cooking?
You know what? You kind of nailed it with getting out. And we're very lucky where we live some of the year. You know, we can walk out into a beautiful day in the summer. In the winter, we just have to put on our wellies and our raincoat and go out anyway. For me, it's the dogs. I always have a dog. I had two lovely dogs who got elderly and, you know, went over the Rainbow Bridge. And last fall, I adopted two rescued puppies from two different organizations, and so they are Daisy and Doug.
Aww.
Yes, and just heading outside with them and watching, you know, their curiosity about the world and racing around and sniffing, it just kind of readjusts the world for me.
Mm. So let's talk about the connection here, because you mentioned your mom just, but you at some point in the pandemic, and maybe still it's going on, have four generations of your family around you constantly. How does that work, and what's going on?
The only possible way it works is that we live in a compound now. You know, I bought this lovely house many years ago, and it's not a huge home, but it's got a nice big parcel on the beach on Bainbridge Island. But it does happen to have a pretty well-appointed guest house that was previously built. And then my husband Jerry built his atelier. And so it just turns out, just as it happens, we have accommodations for everybody. So whenever the family needs to gather, they tend to come here because we have so much space. And my mom is like the Pope. Everybody comes to see her. And so, in fact, just up until yesterday, we had a house full. And the my mom's name is Lou, and her youngest great-granddaughter is named Lou. So little Lou from Texas and old Lou who lives with us were together for several weeks in the summer, and it's been delightful. You know, it's a lot, and you're looking after a lot, but there's no substitute for it.
No, and I think times like we've been going through make that so much more apparent.
We actually had a good COVID story, a good bad COVID story. Baby Lou was only going to stay here with her parents they only had about a week because of work obligations, but mom and dad got COVID somewhere and ended up having to stay like 2.5 weeks with us. And I celebrate the effectiveness of vaccines, because nobody got really, really ill. My niece, who's the baby's mother, did get quite ill, but she took the now famous Paxlovid right away, and it was quite remarkable to see her to see after even one dose how effective that was. I mean, she literally rose from the sick bed and got back down to the business of raising her one-year-old. So
that's good to hear. Good to hear. Well, Susan Wiggs, it's always such a pleasure talking with you. I know listeners can find out much more about you and your work at susanwiggs.com. I know you're also very active on Facebook and have quite a big following there. The book is called Sugar and Salt. Final word you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I just want to let readers know how incredibly grateful I am for the independent bookstores that have rushed into the breach, especially during the pandemic, to bend over backwards to serve readers and give them. So if you have any love to give it to booksellers this year.
Yeah, I would echo that. I hate to see bookstores going out of business and our choices being limited more and more every day. So yes, support those independent bookstores. Susan Wiggs, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, cheers to you, Vicky. I hope to talk to you again soon.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.